UEG Talks, gastroenterology to go. Welcome to our GI podcast. Listen for fresh insights and perspectives in science, education, and professional development.
Welcome to this episode of the UEG Talks. My name is Pradeep Mundre, and I'm your host for today. Now, I remember many years ago, I was doing poster rounds at the UEG Week, and I came across this poster on artificial intelligence. And I was very excited. I was amazed. And I felt at that time that this could be a game changer within gastroenterology. And that was my first ever exposure to artificial intelligence. Many years down the line, that excitement has now turned to confusion. I'm always these days wondering, the more I read about these things, the more confused I get, although certain things are becoming clear. And of course, that's probably related to my lack of knowledge on understanding the basic concepts of AI. I still don't know how there's so many RCTs published these days. I still don't know how relevant they are, how I can interpret these RCTs, how they are relevant to my current clinical practice. So I just feel demystifying all this seems very difficult, and certainly for me. To clarify these things, we have two amazing guests today from the world of artificial intelligence. Hopefully, they'll make it clear for us. Firstly, we have Dr. Alana Ebigbo. Alana is a gastroenterologist and head of the endoscopy department at the University Hospital Augsburg in Germany. Alana is also an interventional endoscopist focusing on third space endoscopic procedures and has special research interest in AI in endoscopy, focusing on upper GI tract. And we all know Alana is also one of the authors of the ESG position statement on artificial intelligence. Joining Alana today is Dr. Louis Lau. Louis, I know him personally from the UG Week. He's an assistant professor at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. Louis has special interest again in the research in artificial intelligence in endoscopy and has published widely with a recent RCT on detection of colorectal polyps using artificial intelligence. Louis is also an emerging star of the World Endoscopy Organization. Welcome to UEG Talks, Louis and Alana.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. I'm very happy to be here with you. And thanks again, Pradeep and UEG's invitation for me to join this podcast. I'm sure we will have a very fruitful discussion.
Thank you, guys. So, Louis, maybe I'll start with you. I just want to start with our first discussion, sort of to understand the sort of basic terms. So whenever I come across any paper, and there's a lot of these terms mentioned, you know, artificial intelligence, neural networks, machine learning, deep learning. So I always struggle to understand these concepts. Is there any chance you can make simple kind of simple terms, what these things mean? I think because it's important for us to understand this before we move on to the next discussions.
Yeah, sure. I think this is a very common question and very difficult to answer if we go into the deep details. But I think I can make a simple analogy that basically artificial intelligence is a very general term. And it is actually to describe the development of very smart computer systems that can perform tasks requiring human intelligence, such as the visual perception, speech recognition, like the decision making or language translation that very commonly encounter in our daily life. But what goes into the further deep details will be the other branches of AI. So actually, machine learning is one particular sub-branch of AI that just focus on using some big data or some algorithms to enable the AI to act like human and improve the accuracy, and mainly involving three major parts, including making the decision, making errors, and then learning and optimize from these errors so that it can be further divided into either the supervised or the non-supervised way, depending on the degree for human intervention. And for the deep learning is further a subfield for the machine learning. So it is another like improved version of machine learning so that it does not necessarily require a properly labeled data set, because the deep learning itself can already digest the unstructured data in the raw format. And it eliminates some of the human intervention and well-known as unsupervised learning. And then by using this, it can further push the limit of AI. And I just take a very simple example to illustrate that. Just like when we choosing lunch in a restaurant, whether we want a pizza or a burger, for machine learning, like the supervised learning, so we really rely on the labels on the menus. We read the words on the menus. But deep learning can actually distinguish by the pictures, by just looking at the characteristics like the sausages, like the ham, et cetera, et cetera. So these are the two different mindsets. And for one more term, what we call a neural network, actually is just a form. And it actually this is the backbone of a deep learning because it is actually the algorithm itself and mostly consisted of, some input layer, some hidden layers, and also a output layer just to simulate the complex decision-making of a human brain. So I hope by clarifying these terms, our audience can be more clear on the concepts for AI, and then we can further discuss on the utilization in GI.
Yeah, so that's a very good analogy, Louis. So these things are really intelligent, judging by what you sort of mentioned. So they're just not machines in a way. Now, moving on to you, Alana, I do remember sort of joining you for one of the meetings, and you had a whole team of engineers, researchers who were working on developing AI systems. And I feel that it's important to understand basic concepts, how these are developed, will help us to interpret the clinical trials, for example, and how they are relevant to our clinical practice. So would you be able to just explain to us briefly how they are developed?
Yeah, thank you, Pradeep, for this question. It's a good one. Basically, the whole thing starts off with identifying the need. So the clinical need needs to be identified first. Let's use the example of Barrett's, for example. Barrett's dysplasia, we have a high miss rate for Barrett's dysplasia. Now, the need is there to develop models or systems that assist non-Barrett experts in identifying and detecting Barrett's dysplasia. Then, when you have identified the need, you need to start collecting data. This is still on a clinical background, but still at this point, the clinician already needs to talk with the engineer to decide what sort of data needs to be collected, in what quality, in what format, and how much of this data needs to be annotated by the clinician. Now, the quality of data, we'll speak about this definitely along the line, but the quality of data is very important because the more diverse the data is that you're collecting, the more robust your AI model will be at the end. So when you have collected the data you need, you start annotating this data. Even though we work with neural networks and deep learning in computer vision, you still need some form of annotation. The AI system still needs to understand what to look out for.
Can I briefly stop it there, Alana? When you say annotation, so can you explain that a little bit more?
Yes, it's actually quite simple because on an image, you are working with an image and pattern recognition AI model. That's computer vision. But in order to improve your accuracy and to make the system as precise as possible, the clinician can draw, for example, a bounding box or a circle around a region of interest.
Okay, that's your displaced dysplastic area within the Barrett's.
Exactly right. Exactly right. It's still some form of labeling that you need. Now, when you have done this, the engineer starts his work. He designs his model. It's usually deep learning because the intricacies involved and the difficulty in solving these image recognition tasks is quite high. So we usually work in this area with deep learning systems. Now, you have different methods that engineers use. Each of these neurons within the neural network have weights and gradients. You do a positive and negative feedback loop. It's called backpropagation. But finally, at the end, the AI system has learned to differentiate between A and B. Then the next step comes where you need to validate and test the system. You need to remember the most important point in the validation step is you have to validate your system also with external data. Not just internal data. You need to collect external data that the AI system has never seen before. Finally, when you've done your validation and testing, you go into regulatory approval and deployment along the line. So this is basically the wrap-up of what happens in the background.
And when you say you annotate data. Are these still images that you present to the computer, or is it, you know, real life, an endoscopy that happens in 6 minutes, you know, where Barrett's is examined over 1 minute or so? So what goes on to these things?
Yeah, you always start on a basic step. So the first basic step is to collect still images and annotate these still images. Finally, in the training process, you will use videos to train the system. But remember that each video is made up of frames, and each frame in itself is a kind of a still image, which the computer vision model is working with. So it's a bit difficult, like splitting hairs, to say, do we need a still image or do we need a video? The AI system uses each frame to train itself.
So Alana, just understanding these concepts of how you said, you know, you develop a training set and you develop a validation set. So the results or the performance of each system is probably unique to that system, right? You can't really generalize this, or let's say AI in Barrett's dysplasia works, or works in detecting dysplasia. So my understanding, based on what you said about the concept, is that you can't really translate that to make it general, that all AI systems work the same. Is that correct or is that wrong?
It's partially correct. So when we talk about generalizability, it's a broad concept. We need to remember that all these systems in computer vision, especially in endoscopy, are narrow AI systems. They solve that particular task that they were trained to solve. So when I train a system to detect or characterize Barrett's lesions, I cannot generalize this system to stomach cancer. That doesn't work. But what I can do, and what we should expect from systems, this is what we call robustness. Robustness of a system is, if a system works well in Augsburg, this system should be able to work equally as well in Hong Kong. And this system should also work equally as well in New York City. So first of all, robustness within, between, or among centers, but also coming to different providers of endoscopy equipment. We have various providers, and a robust AI system should be able to work well on every other provider of endoscopy equipment. So when I'm using Olympus, Fuji, Pentax, or whatever, it should be able to work well and detect and characterize these images. So this is what we call robustness of the AI system.
I fully agree with Alana that a generalizable AI system should be working in every part of the world, using different endoscopy systems on a single disease. But in the future, I think different AI models can be combined into a simple box. Then in that day, the single AI system can be used for different diseases. But for the development of an AI system, we usually need to identify a single problem to solve first.
Yeah. I want to go touch a little bit more, dig deep into this topic. You mentioned that, you know, if you develop a system, let's say, I don't know, let's give a name. So you guys have developed in Augsburg a system. Let's say your system says, okay, fine, it's superior to human in detecting dysplasia in Barrett's. It detects more dysplasia. And let's say my friend from France or somewhere develops another system, and you've published your studies in an RCT or whatever that your system works. And my other friend from France develops a system. He doesn't test it. And he claims that, or yes, she claims that, well, the AI systems work in improving dysplasia. Can you buy my product? Is it generalizable that way?
Yeah, a very good question. It's very hard to answer. And I think it all depends on the regulatory approvals, because in my perspective, still very hard to put things like that by using on a single platform or one single indication to ask for a regulatory approval. My analogy is just like the drug registrations. They are like many similar diabetic drugs or oral anticoagulants, like they are of similar class and mode of actions. But the current regulatory approval boards will still need the individual drug to perform its own trial and provide its own safety data before each drug can be registered. So another issue behind this is different AI platforms may have totally different raw data format or the algorithm designs, and all these factors may hinder the ideal situation for performing one single trial using it all around the world. So we definitely need to work more on this. What's your thought, Alana?
I absolutely agree, and I love your analogy with the drugs. Finally, we must remember that the AI system being developed in France or in another part of the world for the same task is being developed with a different set of data that was used for the development of an already approved system. So even though, and also probably a different model, no two models are finally the same at the end. And for this reason, each newly developed model or system will need to undergo separate regulatory approval, at least for the time being.
So it's like, Alana, you coming up with a Mercedes S-Class and say, oh, I can reach, 500 miles per hour. And then I produce maybe Fiat Picanto and say, oh, Alana's already proven that this car runs at 500 miles per hour. So thanks for making that clear, guys. So on that basis, maybe Louis, you can answer this. I recently came across meta-analysis on computer-aided detection. They combined several RCTs in various fields, and they said, oh, there's a combined increase in ADR from 25 to 36%. So that's not quite right, right? So you can't really combine these data into make it a meta-analysis out of this. I mean, conceptually, that seems wrong to me.
I think partially correct. And personally, I think the meta-analysis, the main aim is to like group together all the similar design RCTs to look for a like cumulative effect contributed by different RCTs. But we always remember that there are heterogeneities in different trials, like the endoscopers, like the countries, and also all the scope systems. So we really need to interpret with care. So I think it just generally gives us a concept that the overall ADR can be like boosted up for around 10% by combining all this. But of course, we need to go into the details of the different RCTs before we can like say it is generally applicable. But for CAT, I believe this is quite optimistic because there are many, many trials of different heterogeneity covering different scenarios. So personally, I'm quite optimistic on this.
Within individual trials, is the benefit that's been published or benefit that's been found, is it similar or is there a wide variation in the documented or published benefits?
I think at least for CAT-E, the computer detection is generally quite along the same line. Most trials are positive ones, increasing of around 5 to 10% of the ADR. And in different situations, like different endoscopists or different indications. So for now, I think the evidence is quite robust. This is what we call the robustness in different scenarios, different part of the world, still providing the same conclusion.
Well, I can just add one point to that. It's interesting. Maybe we will have time to speak about it later on as well. I think we always need to remember by these RCTs, and there is no way of doing this, that the examiners are not blinded to what they are doing. There is this Hawthorne effect where examiners do their best to perform in a randomized controlled trial. So we just need to remember this. But as Louis said, it's not a coincidence that all these RCTs are producing similar good results.
So Alana, I just want to move on to the upper GI tract. You mentioned earlier on that you identify a clinical need first. You develop your system based on that clinical need. So in your opinion, what would be the expected value of AI systems in general, in the upper GI tract? Where do you want these to perform? So is there any definitions for those? Or what's your benchmark?
Yeah, thank you very much. Well, the expected value of AI in the upper GI tract, we actually published the ESGE, actually published a position statement exactly on this expected value of AI. In the upper GI tract, as probably in all aspects of endoscopy, maybe we could split it into three categories. So the first category is pre-endoscopy. What happens before the patient undergoes his examination? How can AI be of benefit and what can we expect of AI? For example, improvement in appointment scheduling. So making sure that we don't have overlaps between patients or double appointments or missed appointments. So this can reduce the administrative burden of non-medical personnel planning these procedures. Then when we come into the endoscopic, the phase of the endoscopy, that's the second category. This is where we usually understand AI to be of benefit to physicians. So we can talk about improved mucosal exposure. That is, for example, the AI system is reminding you of your blind spots. We can also, again, reduce the administrative burden by doing an automatic photo documentation or an automatic reporting so that the physician at the end of the procedure has his report. And then we can delve into what we usually understand AI to be. That is actually computer vision aspect of AI, which is lesion detection, lesion characterization, lesion segmentation. So within the endoscopic phase, we have improved the quality, but now the AI system is assisting us and improving our neoplasia and dysplasia detection rates. Remember the example of Barrett's, for example, with an AI system, we can expect an AI system to improve the neoplasia detection rate of Barrett's non-experts to a level of experts. And then finally, in the post-endoscopy phase, in this subcategory, the patient has undergone his endoscopy. We have our report. The AI has generated our report. We have sent the patient home, and we have automatic AI-assisted planning for subsequent surveillance, recall of patients, rescheduling of patients. So this is probably a summary of a workflow from pre to post-endoscopy, what we can expect actually of AI in the upper GI tract.
That's way more than what I thought AI is doing in the upper GI tract, Alana. That's good summary. Thanks for that. I guess for me as a clinician, probably the most important bit is missed lesions or lesion detection or dysplasia improvement, and particularly probably focusing on Barrett's or stomach, both, let's say. That's where I think, you know, most things are missed. Can you summarize currently where we stand in 2024? Where we stand in terms of the lesion detection is concerned in the upper GI tract, where do the AI systems stand in this world? Are they ready for prime time use in the clinical practice?
That's the decisive question, Pradeep. And in the upper GI tract, as opposed to the lower GI tract, things are a bit more difficult. So in the lower GI tract, the solutions are polyp detection, adenoma detection and characterization. But in the upper GI tract, we have much less data to work with. Think of Barrett's lesions, for example. They are rare, and we need to remember that, as we've talked about, we need to produce a system that is robust, that doesn't have an overfitting bias. We need a system that works in different hands, in different centers, reliably and reproducibly. So at the moment, there is only one system that has been approved. There are a number of research groups, and I'm sure in the next 2 to 3 years, there will be new systems being approved. Remember that MDR, our medical device regulatory approval systems in Europe, has become a bit more difficult. But I expect there to be new systems coming into the market in the next few years, especially for lesion detection in Barrett's. In squamous cell cancer, we have even less data for SCC in the Western setting. So this is probably what we will expect from Asian countries, AI models for detection and characterization of SCC, and also for the stomach. So the paucity of data in the West, especially for SCC and stomach cancer, will even delay further any devices coming out on the markets. I think the first things we will be seeing in the next few years, more devices for Barrett's characterization and lesion detection.
So in summary, currently, so mainly in a research setting, but watch this space, things will probably, the landscape will change. Same thing in clinical practice, Alana. Lower GI tract, it's easy. In lesion detection, I think we struggle with lesion detection in the upper GI tract, even as humans. So it looks like machines have got similar problem to us in a way. Is that what you think?
That's absolutely right. Absolutely correct. And to underline what you just said now is that the expected value of AI for Barrett's is not to improve expert performance. We cannot expect that. But what we are downgrading it a little bit, but very important because it's the Barrett's non-experts that are performing the gross of procedures, of surveillance procedures, of routine procedures. So the aim is to improve the quality of endoscopy, especially around lesion detection of non-experts to the level of experts.
Okay. Even detection is in the early stages. Any strides made in the field of lesion characterization? I guess, I don't know, that's not so relevant maybe in the upper GI tract, but anything going on?
Yeah, good point. Yes, definitely. There's a lot of research going on there. If we remain in the Barrett's domain, lesion detection and characterization for Barrett's goes almost hand in hand because you need to differentiate between dysplasia and non-dysplasia. What is particularly difficult in Barrett's is to distinguish between dysplasia and inflammation. We have seen from most systems that this is proving quite difficult. Now, when we go to the stomach, we need to remember that we also want to have systems that help us in characterizing pre-neoplastic conditions. For example, atrophic gastritis or intestinal metaplasia, also aiding and guiding physicians in their biopsies. So we should not only be talking of, in the stomach at least, only be talking of early gastric cancer, but also pre-neoplastic conditions.
Okay, that's interesting. And I argue, you take your point on inflammation and dysplasia. I think even for humans, it's not easy.
Exactly. Even for pathologists.
Yeah, exactly. There will be some difficulty in differentiating between it.
So the point will be then, how do we define the gold standard when we differentiate between dysplasia and inflammation? When we have histological reports telling us it is indefinite for dysplasia, or low-grade dysplasia where we need two pathologists to confirm. And then judging from all the already existing paucity of data. So these are points that will make Barrett's evaluation with AI even more difficult.
Yeah. I guess the point to make is it's not clear cut. And when you dig in deeper, there's so many ifs and buts and things like that.
Correct.
Alana, just want to move on to the quality of upper GI endoscopy, which is always a bit difficult thing. I think the quality parameters in colonoscopy are well established, you know, post-colonoscopy cancers, adenoma detection, much easier. The upper GI tract, I don't think so there's any clear-cut quality parameters. Maybe you can consider post-endoscopy upper GI cancer as probably something maybe coming up in the future, I feel. Are there anything in the field of AI researchers are looking into improving the quality of endoscopies at all?
Good point. So there are quality parameters. Just take the example of photo documentation. Now, when we as endoscopists do accurate and precise meticulous photo documentation, we improve the quality of our examination because we are reducing our blind spots. It's okay. So you can imagine AI systems that are already there, AI systems assisting endoscopists in automatic photo documentation and hinting them on the blind spots. So saying, that upper left corner in the fornix, please have a second look at it. You've not seen it yet. So mucosal exposure, for example. Then the second point is, let's move to the esophagus. We all know that when we have a Barrett segment, we need to take our time. It's similar to the withdrawal time in the colon. There is data that shows that per 1 minute assessment per centimeter of Barrett, we will improve our dysplasia and focal lesion detection rates. So we could have an AI system also assisting us in checking the quality of our Barrett's assessment, for example. And then there was an interesting, again in the research setting, but an interesting study published in gastroenterology where the esophagus, the Barrett segment, was post-endoscopy reconstructed three-dimensionally so that after endoscopy, the physicians could have a second look at the Barrett's segment. There is a lot of work in progress. There's a lot of music. But as I said, these things still need to be tested and validated before regulatory approval can be done.
To follow this point, actually, I have a question for Alana, because as Pradeep already mentioned, there are no very good quality indicator in the upper GI tract. So I foresee a very difficult clinical trial to define the endpoint. So what's your view on this particular point?
Yeah, I think the endpoint will always be the dysplasia detection rate. the neoplasia detection rate. That will always be the endpoint. The absolute endpoint is actually our mortality rate. Does AI reduce in any way our mortality rate? But that is almost utopic at the moment. So let's take it one step lower. And I think it will be with an AI system assisting photo documentation, assisting the cleanliness of the stomach. Also, it's an issue in the stomach, cleanliness of the stomach. Then mucosal exposure, inspection time, all these things. The parameters that will be used for such a study will not be, well, the AI system did 2 more images than without the AI system. No, the parameter should be, with an AI system improving the quality of my procedure, I was able to find more neoplasia.
Thanks, Alana, for that. I just want to wrap up the upper GI side of things. And I think, Alana, you said that there is already one system in the market. Is there good evidence to say that the real-time AI-guided target biopsies will improve your dysplasia rate of a non-expert to match it to the expert? Is there enough evidence currently to say that?
That's the expected value, but the evidence is not yet sufficient. Moreover, Pradeep, remember that we will not be comparing AI-targeted biopsies to targeted biopsies without AI. We will be comparing AI-targeted biopsies alone with the standard of care. And the standard of care is virtual and dye-based chromoendoscopy with, for example, acetic acid, plus the Seattle biopsy protocol. For at least, we're talking now for Barrett's. Now, if you do your Seattle biopsy protocol meticulously, will you really be missing more lesions than when you use AI for targeted biopsy? So will we be discovering more neoplasia per patient with AI targeted biopsies as compared with standard of care? That's the first question. Second question is, will we be discovering more neoplasias per biopsy with AI as compared with the Seattle biopsy protocol plus standard of care? So yes, the second question, probably yes, and will be probably more cost effective. But finally, per patient, on the per patient level, can we show that AI targeted biopsies will really produce more neoplasias per patient than a meticulously done standard of care?
Thank you so much, Louis and Alana. That was a wonderful summary of understanding the AI nomenclature and AI in the upper GI tract. Thanks for taking time off your busy schedule to be here. For the sake of time, I think we'll end part one of this episode here. Be sure to tune back for the part two of this episode next Wednesday, the July the 10th, when we discuss AI in lower GI tract. See you soon. Bye.